from Boca Raton, Florida, this is Behind the Bima. On this episode, the rabbis mourn the loss of two giants in the Jewish world, Rabbi David Feinstein and Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks. The rabbis are joined by Rabbi Tzvi Rum of the Bialystoker Synagogue, who discusses his relationship with Rav David and the lessons he learned from watching and interacting with him. Then, Chazan Shim Kramer discusses his close relationship with Rabbi Lord Sacks and shares memories from the time spent at his side. All this and more Behind the Bima.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is Wednesday night, 9 p.m. I am Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg, joined by my dear friends and colleagues, Rabbi Philip Moskowitz and Rabbi Josh Brody. And we are here to take you
behind the Bima.
We're here to go behind the Bima. Now, the truth is we have a lot to talk about tonight, as we always do. But tonight is also a somber night, a night of reflection, as we are going to join Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people around the world, are really in a week in a state of grieving, having lost two heroes, two leaders, two truly irreplaceable. Every human being is irreplaceable, but in many ways unique, extraordinary, irreplaceable people. And we'll have the opportunity to reflect on them tonight and to bring on people who knew them very personally to share their personal reflections and their connections. And we're grateful for that opportunity. We want to thank our dear friend Stephen Meltzer and the Meltzer family for sponsoring tonight. Deeply appreciated. Stephen's out in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Might be back in Boca right now, but whether it's in Wyoming or Boca, the Meltzer family, we are very appreciative to them. The Moscow, because this one's calling you.
It's so, not me.
It's whoever's calling her by Moscow. Please hang up right now. Right. But in any case, there's a lot going on, and we're going to jump right in with Rabbi Ram to this evening of reflection and tribute. So it is our pleasure here at Boca Raton Synagogue and Behind the Bima to welcome on Rabbi Tzvi Ram. Rabbi Ram and I actually go way back. I believe we're in camp together, Moshe Kolel, Karen Biavna, Yeshiva University, and we are old friends. And it's a pleasure to see you, to welcome you. Unfortunate it is for these sad reflections and the loss of Rav David Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Kadosh Levracha. But we're grateful you've given us a few minutes tonight.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here, to see everybody, to participate. We go back over 25 years, but we're both 30. So
exactly.
That works out pretty well.
The math doesn't work, but we're going to stick with it nonetheless. So for those who don't know, and everybody does, Rabbi Ram is the Rav of the Bialystoker Shul on the Lower East Side. He's a Rebbe at Yeshiva University. He's also the administrator of the Manhattan Beis Din for Conversion of the Beis Din of America. Wear many hats and play many roles. I don't know how you get it all done in any given day, Rabbi Ram. And there's so much that's worth talking to you about, just about your own life. But tonight we're here to talk about Rav David Feinstein. Rav David, the Rosh Hashiva, as he was affectionately known. I listened to the Hesped, the eulogy you gave on YU Torah for him. And tell us, please, a little bit, how long have you been in the Lower East Side? When did you first meet Rav David? What are some of your personal reflections about what that relationship was like? I was once at a wedding, and I was honored to be called to read the Ksuba, and Rav David was there. And I don't know that I was ever so nervous or shaking as having to read a Ksuba in front of one of the Gedolei Hador, in front of one of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, in front of Rav David Feinstein. So that was reading a Ksuba for a few moments, and I got to leave after that. You were a Rav in the very same community where the Rosh Hashiva was. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, so, I mean, the long and short of it is it was a tremendous privilege. Just a little bit in terms of background. So I'm in Bialystoker Shul now on the Lower East Side for a little over 18 years. And I actually met Reb David even before coming down and being officially offered the position. We came out for a Proba Shabbos, a trial Shabbos, as every Rav has, you know, the trial by fire. And at the very end of Shabbos, Motzei Shabbos, I was told by one of Reb David's Gaboim that he wanted to bring my wife and myself up to the apartment to meet the Rosh Hashiva and the Rebbe. And I think this was something that they did with all of the candidates for the position. So, you know, as nervous as you probably were reading that Ksuba, I think I was more nervous, probably much more nervous. You know, there was a lot kind of riding on that meeting informally. So, you know, my wife and I came up to the apartment, and Reb David answered the door in his shirt sleeves, no tie, no jacket, shalom aleichem, nice to meet you. We came, we sat at the dining room table, he, his Rebbetzin, Tibbadlo L'chaim Rebbetzin Malka, myself, my wife, the Gabbai who brought us up. And it was just like chatting, you know, not very long. He was not a talkative person, but something that always characterized any interaction with him was that beautiful smile that you see in so many of the pictures of Reb David. I think we were in Eretz Yisrael together when Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, was alive. Certainly, I once had the opportunity to interact with him. I remember also, and you see in the pictures, the tremendous beaming smile that Reb Shlomo Zalman always had. Reb David Zatzal had a different kind of smile. It was the shy smile of somebody who was just so simple, so Behat Snei Aleches, you know, in his mannerisms, as was described at the funeral. It struck me, you know, one of the things that you really have to understand in order to really appreciate Reb David is the Lower East Side community as a whole, because in certain ways he wore two hats. He was the posek for America, for a very, you know, in a very real sense. Rav Yoshev Zatzal would send people to him in America for psak halacha. He considered him to be the foremost posek in America. You know, he got shilas from all over the place. You came into MTJ on any given day, and people from all over were lining up to try to speak to the Rosh Yeshiva. But he was a very proud son of the Lower East Side, who had lived in the Lower East Side basically since he was a child, and had a tremendous fondness for the neighborhood. As I spoke about a little bit in the Hesped I gave in YU, the neighborhood had a tremendous, has a tremendous fondness for him. You know, I was thinking, everyone always refers to Harav Hagon, you know, the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav David Feinstein. It struck me, you know, Gaon we always use in the sense of, you know, accomplished Talmudic scholar, you know, great genius. But Gaon also means the pride. Gaon Yisrael is the pride of Israel. And it struck me that in that sense, that term is really applicable to the Rosh Yeshiva Zatzal. He was the pride of the neighborhood. Some people knew him more, some people knew him less, but there was no such thing as someone who had no idea who he was. You know, it's, again, it's a small neighborhood, 250 mishpachas that are Shomer Shabbos were all kind of, you know, scrunched into about five blocks, you know, in this little Manhattan area. So, and the Rosh Yeshiva was all over the place, you know. I mean, he would walk back and forth from his house to the yeshiva until the last couple of years when it was difficult for him. His devotion to the yeshiva, by the way, was such that when he couldn't walk to the yeshiva on Shabbos anymore, they built him an apartment in the yeshiva. And with tremendous Mesiras Nefesh, if you think about it, for an elderly couple, he and his wife basically moved into this makeshift apartment in the yeshiva to be there over Shabbos so that they could be mechazik the yeshiva over Shabbos.
Wow.
Tremendous Mesiras Nefesh for him, Mesiras Nefesh for his Rebbetzin, you know, in a very, very real way.
Extraordinary. You know, for those watching and those listening, you know, I know everybody knows, but nevertheless, we're talking about Rav David Feinstein, the son of the great Rav Moshe Feinstein, who really took over. Rav Moshe Feinstein, of course, in the 20th century, was undisputable as the halachic leader, who really, if you want to understand Jewry in America in the 20th century, you study Rav Moshe's tshuvas, because those were the cutting-edge issues of the day, and Rav David essentially was his successor in that role. And as you said, people came from all over and all communities. I think it's extraordinary. Our Rebbe, Rav Schechter, who's an extraordinary posek in his own right, also would consult or would say that he needs to present a shaila to Rav David. And I know that you said that Rav Schechter asked you on occasion to consult with Rav David to be able to find out. We'll come back to that in one moment. But if you could speak more about, because the part that really strikes me and is an inspiration, the fact that Rav David at a young age knew Kol HaTorah Kula, knew Shas, knew so much that his own father, Rav Moshe, referred to his genius. It's hard for me. I'll never achieve that. I'll never achieve that. I'm much more limited in the gifts that Hashem gave me. I won't achieve that. But the way in which he was so unpretentious, the way in which he never dressed like a Rosh Yeshiva, he wore a simple suit and a regular hat. It's described that he preferred to sit in the back of the room with the boys than be in the front of the room with the rabbis. He didn't want attention. He didn't want honor. He wanted to be an unpretentious, regular person. Someone shared with me right before we came on a story that he heard from Rav David Feinstein's gabbai or somebody close with him, that Rav David needed a new hat. So he told Rav David, let's go to the hat store and get a new hat. And when they arrived at the store, he gave Rav David a hat to try on. And Rav David said, why are you giving me the hat? I thought you need the new hat and you wanted me to come. You wanted me to come to help you choose a new one to see which one would look good on you. Could you imagine? He thought that this person wanted him to come to see which hat would look good on him. He was just the quintessential, humble, modest, unpretentious, and not the image we have today, as you said in your eulogy, of a rabbinic leader of that stature who has layers and layers of gabayim, who has a chatzer, who has an insulation, and he was accessible, available, unpretentious, and regular. And I think in that way is a real role model for us all.
It's been described in print, but I think it's worthwhile describing the following for a few moments just here. Reb David's office. In the past few years, the yeshiva built Reb David a new office, you know, a nice rabbinic office that's befitting someone of his stature. Till a few years ago, his office was at the end of the hall when he came into MTJ. It doubled as Reb David's office, the storage room for old svarim, and where they kept the sodas to restock the soda machine.
Wow.
That was his office. You know, he had a little desk and a table, a little desk and a chair, you know, in one corner of that room. The rest of the room was kind of a storage place. And, you know, you sat there with him and you thought, this is the Rosh Yeshiva's office? But he wouldn't have had it any other way. You know, I think they had to prevail upon him to build him a nicer office. When he would come and daven occasionally in our shul during the week, he would sit in the back. It was a little embarrassing, you know, like I would go over, you know, the Rosh Yeshiva wants to come up to the front. No. Yes. After the third time, you can't ask anymore, you know, he doesn't want to come up to the front. But that anivus, that humility, that simplicity, that just characterized him. As I was saying, though, he had this love for the neighborhood. He would do anything for the neighborhood, for the residents of the neighborhood, to help with Shalom Bayis, to help with Chesed. I remember once being in the MTJ Beis Medrash for Mincha. So one of the Gaboyim comes over to me towards the end of davening and says to me, the rabbi wants to speak to you after davening. It's like, oh, I got called into the principal's office. What happened over here? So he, you know, takes me into the office after davening. There's a Shalom Bayis issue in the neighborhood. I know that you're close to one of the parties. Perhaps you could speak to that party, you know, and tell them this, tell them that, tell them the other thing. And, you know, maybe we could figure out a way to help out this couple that are having Shalom Bayis issues. You know, that anything to help somebody else, he was first in line to try to do it.
We can't all be gedolim in Torah. We can't all be great in Torah, but we can all be gedolim in Chesed and learn. Can you describe Rav Schechter asking you to bring shailas to him, or any awareness you have of a relationship between Arabeyim and Rav David and the kind of respect they had between them?
Yeah, so, you know, the Feinsteins and the Soloveitchiks are actually cousins. And, you know, the esteem that the YU Rosh Yeshiva certainly had for Reb David, I guess it's appropriate to say have, you know, even after his passing, you know, was, I think, matched by the sense of kavod that he and Yibodeh L'Chaim Reb Reuven have for the Rav and for the institution of YU. You know, there was never a bad word ever said about YU. You know, notwithstanding the fact that certainly in other circles, one does hear a bad word from time to time. And I, as I mentioned in the hesped that I gave through YU, there were two occasions where Rav Schechter, you know, was grappling with a certain question that came up in the context of Geirus. And in both cases, he said, you know, go ask Rav David. And the way he phrased it, I'm not going to quote verbatim, but the sense of what Rav Schechter said was Rav David was so close to his father. He is the repository of the Mesorah from his father. Wow. And he could give you, you know, an entirely accurate description of what his father either said or would have said, you know, given these particular circumstances where Rav Schechter, you know, certainly, you know, is in the league of those who know Kala Torah Kula, you know, felt that he wanted to get Rav Moshe's perspective on a particular issue as filtered through Rav David. You know, something really extraordinary. By the way, when I spoke to Reb David about these two issues, you know, his response was very offhand. Yeah, you know, that shouldn't be a problem. Yeah, that shouldn't be a problem. You know, it's there was a certain simplicity in how he would react to questions. And I know as a Rav, you know, sometimes you had to probe to try to get a better sense of, you know, what he really holds. He was very laconic. You know, in a somewhat similar sense, you know, tshuvas from Chaim Kanievsky come to mind. you know, King, Lo, Efshar, Eniodea, you know, those sort of things characterized, you know, how David would answer Shilas as well. But it was with the knowledge of Kala Tarakula that he was delivering these, you know, very, very laconic sort of answers.
Rabbi Ram, thank you so much. First of all, it's wonderful to see you as well. I was not your contemporary. I was a student in YU, which I guess gives away my age as well. As Rafunder pointed out, anytime we're talking about Gedolim, there's an inherent danger, especially when you talk about someone, a Gadol, whose last name was Feinstein and who Kola Torah Kula and grew up at the feet of Ramosha Feinstein. And you just assumed that he was born, you know, as the Rebbe books say, that by 3 years old, he knew Kola Torah Kula and he was perfect and he did everything right. Can you describe some of the sides of Rav David that people may not be familiar with, that might not find their way into a Gadol story? Maybe some of the challenges or some of the things that Rav David may have spoken to you about or spoken publicly about, of areas of growth that he was working on throughout his life? Or was he superhuman and he was born as a Gadol?
I don't think there's anyone who's superhuman. As Rav Huttner writes in that famous letter, the Chofetz Chaim, you know, as he describes it, wasn't born as the Chofetz Chaim. You know, he had to work to become that. Rav David was a very guarded person. I don't know. And again, I'm certainly not one to talk. You'd have to talk to, I mean, they're Talmidim, they're family members. It's much, much closer in terms of being able to get a read on him. But I suspect that even those who were very close to him would have a hard time really penetrating the essence of what he was. And I say that just because he was a very guarded person who, although he could kibitz with you, you know, you came to a kiddush, anytime somebody made a kiddush in the neighborhood, he would come, you know, he would sit, he enjoyed a good schnapps, you know, drink a l'chaim with somebody, you know, he was very lovely in that kind of way. But, you know, he wasn't a huge schmoozer, as his grandson, Shlomo Fischelis, said over at the Levaya. Rav David was fond of saying that he was born during the week of Parshas Baal Oscha, and the lesson at the end of Parshas Baal Oscha is don't speak Lashon Hara, which he apparently interpreted to himself as try to limit what you have to say altogether. He was not a talkative person. I think, though, there was a tremendous purity in how he conducted himself. There was a tremendous piety, a very unspoken kind of piety. He did not wave his piety in anyone's face. He had certain chumras that he did not necessarily push on the general public, but he was careful about himself, certain chumras and kashrus and the like. But, you know, there was a certain purity in the way he looked at the world, which was just very genuine. There's a story that I just shared with somebody today, which, you know, I know made a big roshem on me, a big impression on me. It happened during the early days that I was in Bialystok or Shul. And I think anyone who's a Rav, who's trying to plan a program, as Rabbanim sooner or later want to do, would just appreciate this story. So I forget the exact year. I came to Bialystok in 2002, and then everything since then is sort of a blur. It all blurs together. But in the early days, it was one of the times, unfortunately, when there were being missiles shot from the Gaza Strip into Eretz Israel. Unfortunately, that happened more than once. So I don't remember exactly the year, but it was sometime not long after 2002. And Reb David convened the Rabbanim of the neighborhood that we should have a gathering to say Tehillim on behalf of Eretz Israel. And the shul that he suggested that we use was Bialystok Shul, because it's a huge sanctuary. It seats 600, maybe even 700 people, including a balcony. Fine, so we're going to come together, we're going to say Tehillim. And Reb David very atypically gave a public address at that point, talking about things we can do to increase spiritual merits on behalf of Eretz Israel. He was not known for speaking in public, so this was a rare occasion, and people were very almost taken aback by the fact that that he spoke. In that meeting of the Rabbanim, one of the Rabbanim suggested that we should print out Tehillim sheets with the appropriate chapters of Tehillim that we're going to say. The suggestion had been tell everybody to bring their own book of Tehillim, you know. So somebody said, you know, like it's difficult. People have different editions. You know, you're going to flip through. Not everybody can manage with that. You know, maybe we should just print out on a piece of paper all the Tehillim. We do this, by the way, for those, you know, we have a connection to YU. We do this in YU all the time. Every Monday and Thursday when we have to say Tehillim, we print it out. So Reb David stopped and he kind of looked quizzically like he couldn't understand why somebody would say that. He said, I don't understand. We're trying to increase merits for the people in Eretz Yisrael. You're going to generate hundreds of pages of shemos, which are then just going to be disposed of? I don't understand. Why would you do that? You want to get schusim. You want to get merits for Eretz Yisrael. Why would you do something which puts you into a halachically complicated scenario and makes life that much more difficult halachically? So all of us who have ever tried to plan a program, you know that, of course, you know, you're idealistic in planning the program, but there are all these details. And at a certain point, sometimes in planning the program, you get caught up in the details, the programmatic aspects of what you're putting together, as opposed to the, you know, the spirit of what you're putting together. For Reb David, there was no window dressing. You know, this is an evening. We're getting together to get schusim, to get merits for Eretz Yisrael, to daven aveyah for Eretz Yisrael. And anything that detracts from that is just negative. You know, I programmatically, it's a good thing to do. Who cares?
A different perspective.
Purity. There was a purity. By the way, from that time, I really stopped to a large extent making up source sheets for Shiurim. I mean, up until that time, I was making source sheets left and right, like all of us who were trained in YU do. You know, a source sheet is the easiest thing to do. After that time, I really held back a little bit because it made a tremendous impression upon me. Why are you just generating shemos? What do you hope to accomplish by doing that?
Really simplifies things to its core and brings a different perspective, a halachic perspective. I think, listen, tonight's episode, we're really reflecting on these great losses and they have more in common that separates them, and yet they were very different. Lord Rabbi Jonathan Sacks and Rav David Feinstein, you know, people until this week probably wouldn't have put them in the same sentence on many occasions, and yet do because of what this loss means. And I think that one of the common denominators between the two is a throwback to another time, a simplicity. There's no arrogance, there's no pretentious. You know, as we've been talking about, as you've been describing, knowing him firsthand, just loving Jews and loving Klal Yisrael. He was never engaged, Rav David, in controversy. He was never engaged in name-calling or marginalizing or criticizing. He lived his life in a way that he wanted to live, and he was an example for his Talmidim and encouraged people to follow. And that's a throwback. We need Gedolei Yisrael. And that's, I think, why part of the reason it's so profoundly painful for us. Again, each of these losses in their own way, and in a moment we'll bring our good friend Shem Kramer on to talk about Rabbi Lord Sacks. But Rav David, that loss is so painful because that beacon of love and of unity, at the same time uncompromising in Torah and having the shoulders of being the son of Rav Moshe and a gadol in his own right, is such a profound loss. It's such a painful loss. And Rabbi Ram, we're so grateful to you for coming and joining us tonight and sharing some personal reflections. I regret I didn't know him or know him better. In fact, his grandson married my first cousin's daughter. So in some way, by some extension, we're mishpacha. And as I've told you before, my grandmother's brother, Rabbi Shlomo Noman, was a rav in the Lower East Side for many years and very close with the Feinstein family. But the opportunity to know him through you and through the stories that are coming out now is an inspiration to us, and his neshama should have an aliyah and inspire all of us. So thank you for coming on. And another time, we'll have to talk about how you get everything done in a day with all the hats that you wear. We wish you hatzlacha, and thank you so much for your time tonight.
Amen. Thank you. It's wonderful to see you. Wonderful to see all of you. And we should just all have hatzlacha and be able to move on the tragic events of this week, as well as the uncertain times in which we live, and look forward to something which is not just a new normal, but some version of the old normal that we can go back to.
Amen. Amen. Thank you so much. Really all powerful. Right. Really, wow. You know, the personal reflections and the personal touch. Because I'll tell you, the articles are coming out. They're coming out fiercely. They're coming out ferociously, and they deserve to be coming out. I read Yisrael Besser's article. It's out in Mishpacha this week. Is really, really special, and I encourage you to read it. You can read it online, but there's countless articles of people who knew Rav David and sharing their personal stories. But there's one thing to read a print on paper or on the internet. It's another to speak to somebody who knew the Adam Gadol and was invited up to that apartment and knew the way that he operated behind the scenes, and that should be an inspiration to all of us.
I remember after Rav Yashiv was passed away, I was doing a lunch and learn at one of the local hospitals, and someone came over to me. They said, someone who's not particularly knowledgeable about the inner workings of Orthodox Judaism. And they said, I don't understand, you know, what makes a Rav Yashiv different than Rabbi Goldberg or than you or Rabbi Brody? Like what makes a Gadol? What makes, no, because he couldn't understand. You were spoken about him in Shul and I had spoken about him in the class. And he couldn't understand how a Gadol might be different than someone like you or I might be. And, you know, a lot of people, we take for granted that we have acted Gadol, that, you know, you have a relationship with Rav Schechter and Rav Asher Weiss, that you're able to turn to them for questions. But there are many people out there that even if they know the Feinstein name, they certainly never had access to Rav David Feinstein. They've never seen a Gadol in action. And where you talk about the Torah knowledge and the incredible encyclopedic understanding of Shas, it's really the interpersonal part. It's the humility. Mm. It's the things that you and I can emulate and tap into, which I think for many of us is so inspiring.
The humility, the humanity of our own Rebbeim, our own Rosh Yeshiva. Rabbi Brody, what are your reflections?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, you know, first of all, I had a shiur today with my Rosh Yeshiva, with Rabbi Liff, and he was a student of his. He was a student of his father. And, you know, to hear the stories of what he did, same stories you're hearing right now. I heard so many stories about how he treated his Talmidim in the yeshiva, about what he did, and he was instrumental in starting Art Scroll at the time when, I think it was Rabbi Zlotowitz, needed some money to get things rolling. Like
he lent him his life savings.
Yeah, literally lent him his life savings. It wouldn't be an Art Scroll perhaps if it wasn't for him. But I'm just curious why we never really heard about Rabbi David Feinstein. You heard about big Rosh Yeshivas throughout the yeshiva world, both in Israel and certainly in America. You heard about big poskim here and there. And then it's coming out that Rabbi David really was, I mean, according to many, was the posek of American Jewry, but you never really heard it. Is it because you think that he didn't want to put himself out there? You know, Gadolim aren't there to put themselves out there. They don't do that. They're great because they're great, and people know it, you don't get appointed. You just are.
But I'm just wondering the famous New York Times story article, and we're going to bring Shimon in a moment and transition. The famous New York Times story that interviewed Rav Moshe, Posek of America, and asked him, how'd you apply for that position? Who interviewed you?
Right.
Who grants that title? And Rav Moshe, in his classic humility, said, I don't know, somebody once asked me a question, and I guess the way they liked my answer, and then other people started coming and asking questions, and I guess they liked the way I answered their questions, and here I am. And that was Rav Moshe's classic humility, which I guess he transmitted to his son. But I think in the more yeshiva or yeshivish world, they knew of Rav David all along and his role in Matzah Gedolah Torah and beyond. But you're right. He didn't elbow his way in. He wasn't on the Mizrach, on the dais. He didn't have to be a featured speaker. He didn't have to be the Messiah of Shas. He didn't have to. He was confident in who he was. As I said, he didn't dress like a Rosh Yeshiva. He wore a regular suit and he wore a regular hat. He didn't wear the more typical Rosh Yeshiva garb, and I think that says really everything about him.
I see we got another guest coming in, but I'm just wondering, what must it have been like for this guy? I mean, saying a Rosh Yeshiva whose father was the number one, the biggest. Rav Moshe was your father. You can't beat that, right?
Shit's thinking, I got up 4:30 in the morning. The first question better be to me right now.
Rabbi Brody, that could go one of two ways, and we could talk about that another time.
Right.
We could talk about that another time because it really relates to us and our children also, you know, which is rabbis' children. They either want to be just like them or they want to be as far away from them as they can. It really relates to. We want to thank our good friend. Shim has been a good friend to our community for many years. And we go way, way back. And he's come to our community, visited our community, and been part of our simchas. And Shim, I want to first of all thank you for waking up. Shim lives in Modi'in in Israel. He woke up in the middle of the night in order to be able to join us. And that is a reflection of his commitment to us, to BRS, to our friendship, and I think most a commitment to really speaking about the legacy of someone with whom he was extraordinarily close, and that is Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks. Shim Kramer was very, very close. We were close. We hosted Rabbi Sacks, not nearly as close as you, as many others, but I think that's part of his greatness, is so many people felt close. If you read his weekly sheet and never met him, I got several emails from people who said, I never met him, I never heard him live, And yet I feel like I've lost a father. I feel like I've lost a member of the family because he so inspired me. He so touched me, so made me believe. He so gave a voice to what I feel. And if that's the case for the people who never met him, just drank from his well of Torah and wisdom, all the more so for people like you, Shim. So thanks for waking up in the middle of the night. And thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it's these eyes are kind of red here. Sorry. It's like the 19th time I've done this, so it's okay to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning now. It's good to see you guys. It's tough to see you guys in this kind of situation. It's an interesting thing that's going on in my mind of how Rabbi Sacks was not blood family, but yet I feel like I've lost a father figure. It's just a tough time. I feel like everyone, the messages that you had, Rabbi, were just like, make sense to me, that people did lose someone they felt they were related to, even though they weren't, or they saw a few times, but felt like they were literally close family. You had the ability to reach out to so many people in so many ways and in so many different subject matters. And so many, there was always something that he had to say that someone would connect to. There was always, one of the things that for me, Rabbi Ephraim, Rabbi Phil, and Rabbi Josh, you three are unique. I have to tell you, there are not many people that I can connect to when I listen to. I find it difficult. And you three, I obviously, by the way, I really do. I'm not like saying this just because I'm on online with you guys, but Rabbi Sacks connected to me in so many ways, not just personally, but as a Gedolia, I feel a Gedolia Dor, of that generation. I feel like he literally managed to reach everyone. Right. The very, very rare ability to do that.
When you say he reached everyone, he reached not only Jew and non-Jew alike. We know the outpouring of love and affection, admiration, even from the non-Jewish community. But in our own community, Rabbi Brody shared with me, I've never seen this before. Right. Reform and conservative colleagues who were sending out notices to their congregations about this loss and what it means and offering a eulogy for an Orthodox rabbi who was an unapologetic Orthodox rabbi. It's not like Rabbi Sacks, walked the line or apologized for his belief in Torah Misinai, Halacha, Orthodoxy. He was unapologetic and he was unwavering in his commitment. And yet he communicated it in such a way that he even belonged, or they felt he belonged to them, no matter who you were, no matter what your background. So let's take a step back though, Shim, if you don't mind, because when I heard about the passing on Motzei Shabbos, there were a few people that right away I felt I had to reach out to. I couldn't imagine what this loss. Joanna Ben Arush, our good friend Jonathan Marriott's sister, who was really his right hand and worked for, and our heart goes out to her. We think about her and her family tonight. And the next text was to you, that I was thinking about you. To take us back to when you first met Rabbi Sacks. What was your first connection? Because Shim, not only do we know how much you loved him, we also know how much he loved you. Because when he was in our community, we would talk about our shared friends, and he talked about you. And he talked about your voice, which is an instrument. And he talked about your music. And he talked about your soul. And he talked about the projects you did together that he couldn't imagine doing with anybody else. You loved him. He loved you. When did you first meet? How did that relationship form?
I was four. So, that I'm not so sure how much I realized it was but he used to come. I grew up in Hendon in London. I used to go to a shul called Nei Yisrael. Rabbi Kimchi was the rabbi Nei Yisrael. At the time, the chief rabbi, he wasn't the chief rabbi yet, but he, I was six. And he came to help start the shul. We started the shul in 1984. And I just already remember seeing somebody who was like, even at that age, I could connect somehow to. Even at that age, I would sit there and think, wow, this guy's an amazing speaker, and it connected to me, straight away. My major first connection was when I was 18. Rabbi Lionel Rosenfeld, who's the rabbi of the Marble Arch Synagogue in London, he called me up and he used to do this slicha service. They called it the National Slicha Service, where we'd get close to 1,000 to 1,500 people come for midnight slichas every year. And he asked me if I would. It was a duet chazan davening with the choir, the Shabbaton choir. And I was very privileged to be asked if I could, if I wanted to join him for going forward with this, to lead this davening with him. So that was when I was 18, and Rabbi Sacks would be the keynote speaker. Okay, so I used to think, okay, wow, everyone is coming to hear Rabbi Sacks. You know, it's like I'll never forget the image of the buzz that happened in the shul at that time at 12 o'clock at night. People are literally pouring into the shul at 12 o'clock at night, packed. Yeah, you have to close the doors. And obviously the davening was part of it, but I'm saying that you could hear the buzz of they couldn't wait to hear what he had to say.
Wow.
And then combining that with the davening and the singing. And so after he finished his speech, and we started davening, and then after that, I think at 1:30 in the morning, we finished. I had the courage to go up to him and just to say, I said to him, you know, before he could, first of all, he looked at me. The first thing he said to me was, "Shimon." That was Shimon. He used to be so powerful with one word, Shimon. And I was like, oh. And the way he told me how he felt, you know, the davening was, and how he could see it in everything together, and he brought everyone together. He just managed to make you feel like you'd done something, you know, special in a sense.
So Shim, can you elaborate on that a little bit? Because I think one of the things that you intimately are aware of, and I think we are a little bit aware of, is that while most people appreciated Rabbi Sacks for his intellect, his ability to communicate, his eloquence, his ability to articulate things in a way that nobody else could, really music, in many ways that differentiated him from other people, his love of music and his usage of music, a powerful tool in Judaism. And I think that's why you and he connected so well. The first time I ever heard you actually and him was at KJ in Manhattan. It was for a Wexner Fellow event, and you played, and there was a string quartet, and I couldn't get over. Here was this rabbi, this big speaker, and all he could talk about was the music, and he kept on going on and on about the music and how powerful of an instrument music is. Can you talk about maybe a side of Rabbi Sacks that many people weren't aware of, and that was his connection to music and how he used that both for his own personal Judaism and why he felt it was so powerful for other people?
Because from that moment on, we connected through music. That was, for me, my connection to Rabbi Sacks wasn't his everything that everyone loved, you know, in terms of his output, but it was his connection personally to music. You know, for me, we would always talk about music. We would always talk about the connection of the soul, you know, how music was a food for the soul. You know, it was the source of inspiration for the soul. So, from then on, we went on to make a few projects together with music. We first thing we did was we started this tour of solidarity mission with the Shabbaton Choir and Rabbi Lionel and Johnny Turgle, who is a fantastic chazan in London and Stanmore. So he's also a great singer. So he joined us on these tours later on, you know, from 2009 or 2010 onwards. Maybe slightly earlier, anyway. But we started this tour in 2002, and it was built together with him and Rabbi Lionel purely to bring the purity and inspiration that music gives to people in Israel with that needed healing, that needed something. The first one we did was 2002, was right after that Pesach bomb in Netanya, and he would join us. And not only would he join us on the tour, he would join us on the bus. Okay, so he would sit with us. He didn't go in a car behind us in a fancy Mercedes. You know, he sat with us on the bus. Okay, so first of all, that was an incredible opportunity for us to get to know him more personally. There was always music on the bus. There was always something going on, you know, through the system. And very quickly, I'll tell you about that person, that 2002 tour, because it was the first one we did. We managed to, for this Park Hotel, we performed in the hall, the dining room where the bomb had taken place, and they'd arranged it for the survivors and their families of the bomb. Okay, so just to have that, I don't know, they wanted to hear, they wanted to feel, they wanted to have something to like be inspired by and try and find a reasoning for what happened in some kind of way and feel like, you know, that we were all together in this. And just to see the way he spoke and the way he integrated what he said with the music that we sang, and he just had this a fantastic way of understanding our music and Torah, which just one and the same. And we went on to do these tours for years and years. We also went at times that Israel really needed, you know, some inspiration. We went during the Lebanon War. We went up north and we stayed up north and we, during the complete, you know, the crazy time when they were, I mean, they were all, unfortunately, they're always rockets hitting Sderot, but right at the time where there was one every like 5 minutes, you know, it was complete day. We went down there. We actually caught in a missile attack in Sderot when we were down there. We went to perform for hundreds of kids down there that, you know, that needed, you know, some inspiring. Some inspiration, and we had, you know, we danced with them and we sang with them, and then while we were being taken on a tour around the area, we were told to run. He heard the missile go off to a shelter, and we, you know, it flew over our heads and went like 400 yards through a roof of a house. Like we felt like we were really in it, you know, and to have him with us on those trips, I thought we had this protective bubble. You know, yeah. I thought, okay, we're going to be fine. You know, Rabbi Sachs with us, you know, it was just that kind of, and we had talks on the bus about projects, and I'll tell you very, very quickly, two musical projects that we worked on. One was in 2008 called Home of Hope. It was exceedingly Zionistic, Rabbi Sachs. He was totally in love with the state of Israel, loved everything about it. And I never forget this because he used to come to New York a lot. I was living in New York, and he called me up and he said, "Shimon, he goes, I would like to talk about a project. Can we get together?" And the time scheduling didn't work as well to go to where he was staying or you know or where he was speaking. But it worked out that we could get together in Grand Central Station. So I took a train to Grand Central Station, and I met him in the restaurant area. You know where Mendez is? You know where Mendez is in Grand Central? Mm. So you know that kind of there's that area in the middle that has the tables and chairs there? Mm. Imagine, I'm sitting there, and suddenly he just turns up with Joanna, with Lady Elaine, who obviously we'll talk about it very quickly. She was always with him, everywhere. Like she went to every single event with him. You know, this is the love those two had for each other. I mean, I saw it personally in a sense of seeing how they were interacting with each other in a car or in their house. Just, it was incredible.
Real, genuine. Wow.
So she was there and he said, "I want to talk about this project. We want to do 60th anniversary for Israel. We've got to think of 25 songs, 30 songs together. We'll come up with them together about how they would connect to Israel and how I'll introduce each one with something to say." And I said, "Okay, shall we write them down?" And none of us had brought in 2008, none of us brought anything to write down with. We didn't bring a paper, nothing. So what did he do? He took napkins from the table and he asked Rana for a pen. And he started to write songs down on a napkin. I want that napkin. it was just like he just thought on the spot. He thought things. His ideas came together so quickly and so made so much sense. And we came up with these songs. And then we went back. He went back to London. And the second part of this is I came to London for a wedding. And he called. Every time I was in London, I would try and visit him and have some time with him and in his house. And even when he retired from the Chief Rabbinate, moved up to Golders Green, and we'd get together and just, you know, schmooze. And he, when I was in London at the time, he says, "Come over to the house. I wanna just run by the intro for this project." and he was very much in love with classical music. He was very much in love with symphony. All types of music. That was an incredible thing about Rice Sacks. You'd think, you know, it was always one kind of style. It wasn't. He knew so much about music, and he knew so much how each piece that he listened to would connect to him in some kind of way. And one of the songs, one of the pieces of music was the intro to the credits, you know, the music for the credits of a movie to Exodus from 1960. You know, that's, you know, who can sing me the theme song? Who can sing it?
You got it. You take it.
He said, this is perfect to listen, open up this project, right? I remember like going to the, he used to live in St. John's Wood, which is this very fashionable, beautiful neighborhood in London. And he used to live two streets away from Abbey Road. So, you know, the famous crossing. So he used to live two streets away from them. So one time when he asked me to come visit him that time, so he had this gate and a security gate, and he had a security guard that always sat in the front porch of the house in front inside. And then you'd go and, you know, if he'd let you in, then you'd go and see him and sit with him in his room, in his sitting room. So I pressed the buzzer, remember, and I'm expecting to hear the security guard, and I hear this, hello. I was like, Jim. He goes, Jim! And he pushes the buzzer, right? And he goes, calm down, open the door. And he opened the door, and he was in his tracksuit. And I was like, oh, I'm really sorry, did I disturb you? He goes, no, I was just having a workout. Have a work. I'm you know, come in. I said, well, you've got other clothes. I said, realized you just had suits and ties of anything.
Who knew? like everything else, he had a sophisticated view of music. It wasn't simple. He was educated. He was informed. Yeah. I put out earlier this week, and I sent it to you, Shim, that 3 years ago when he had been in our community, at that time we're thinking about a podcast.
Yeah,
like bought this microphone back then, thinking about that podcast. And right before he spoke, before this reception we had, I asked him if I could grab him for a few minutes and did an interview with him. And it just sat in my phone for 3 years. And only when we learned about his passing did I say, I have that interview. And I thank our fact checker, who's the one who still had it and was able to find it easily for me, and posted that interview. And it's a bonus episode of Behind the Bima. And for those watching or listening, go on Behind the Bima online, whether Apple Podcasts or whatever other podcast. It's a 25-minute conversation with him about, did he ever lose faith in God? What happens when he gets distracted in davening? All kinds of topics, which are amazing. But in there, he goes on a riff about music. And he talks about when you struggle with connecting with tefillah, with davening, with prayer, then you have to get into music. And then he pauses and he says, not that kind of new disco music, the new Jewish music where they're basically putting Jewish words to rock music. He's like, real music, the music that stirs the soul. And he goes on about music and the role of music and connecting through music and symphony and its rhythms and its pace and how it opens you up. And like you said before, you know, the pasuk says, "Kis v'lachem es hashir hazos." And Rabbi Soloveitchik says that Torah is likened to music, shira, song. Because just like as one immerses themselves in the music, you immerse yourself in Torah. And Rabbi Sacks immersed himself in whatever he was doing, including the music. But maybe you could speak about what, you know, one last thing. We're so grateful to you for waking up in the middle of the night. His humanity, again, his genius, his brilliance, how many honorary and real degrees, how many books he published. There was the public face of Rabbi Sacks. But something that always struck me, and I don't remember if he said this to me, I doubt he did, or someone close with him shared it, and I wonder if you concur, that Rabbi Sacks by nature was an introvert. He didn't really necessarily need to or feed off of the energy of being in a crowded room and among people and talking. He was more comfortable in a library, in a base medrash, among books, among svarim, researching, writing. And yet he overcame maybe that inclination as an introvert to be there for people. The same vigor and enthusiasm you describe, he greeted you. He made the people he met feel like they're the only thing in the world. He had this modesty. He had this humanity. He had this connection. He had this willingness to check in. as I've shared, and Rabbi Maskot and Rabbi Brody know this and went through this, you know, somebody falsely accused us, our shul, me, of a totally slanderous lie and tried to do this public campaign against us, which thank God amounted to a big nothing. But it could feel lonely and it felt depressing when going through it. And all of a sudden the phone rang and it was Rabbi Sachs, the chief rabbi. How did he have my number? How did he know this was going on? And how did he find the time to make the one phone call that would lift those spirits and make you feel like $1 million? And we're a tiny example. There are countless stories, examples. So speak to his humanity, not just the brilliance and the genius, but Rabbi Sachs, you alluded to as the husband, as the father, as the friend, as the simple person.
For someone of that stature to have, he had the ability to talk to anyone. And he had the ability, as you said, to make anyone feel like you were his best friend. On the other hand, he was also a very shy person in a sense of how do I put this? His humanity, I don't know how to put it. It's very difficult to put it. But his ability to speak to you from his personal side, when he took away everything that he had in his brain, it was always something that it's very difficult to put. He was quiet. He was quite quiet in some ways when you were with him on his own. You could see he was always thinking, but when there was always an issue that was on his mind, he would open up, like he would suddenly talk to you and want to work with you and want to be with you and want to make you feel better and want to help you work through a problem. You know, we've all had situations in our lives that we need someone to talk to. And he knew that moment was the moment that you really needed him. Mm. Again, that's when he kind of didn't, you know, he came out of his shell and he was with you and he knew that you had someone with you at the time, you know.
You're very fortunate. It's a great bracha in your life to have had that closeness with such a special, irreplaceable person.
Yeah. We hosted in Riverdale a couple of times, Rabbi Sachs, and we had him. He actually stayed in the house, and I thought to myself, who can I invite Friday night with Rabbi Sachs? And I said to Ruthie, I said, you know, okay, we've got to think about this. Who are we going to have? And we want him to feel comfortable and we want him to talk. And down the road, we had Senator Joe Lieberman lives in the neighborhood. So we thought, okay, this is perfect, right? So we invited Senator Lieberman to the house and it was a Friday night. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm just going to make Kiddush. I'm going to wash. And I finished that and we sat down and I looked at both of them and I said, okay, it's all yours. Okay. I'm just going to watch, you know, nice. We have the secret recording. We didn't, but and then he just like became, even with Senator Lieberman, he got out his shell and he became so personal and so, you know, easy to listen to and talk to, and every matter under the sun he wanted to talk to you about. And it was just, you know, it was easy. And the reason why I say this story is because we had, unfortunately, that night was the night of one of the biggest storms in New York, rainstorms in New York for years and years and years. I thought this is perfect timing. And we had where we were staying in the basement, we used to before we moved, we fixed it, was to have, we had problems with flooding. And I every while they were talking, I kept thinking to myself, oh gosh, bet you the garage is flooding. I bet you the garage is flooding. So I slipped out quickly and went downstairs to the basement and I opened the garage door and the water is just pouring. What do I do? Anyway, so I said, Ruthie, we have to fix this. And meanwhile, they're still talking, completely oblivious that I've left the room. And I just remember, you know, we got the water out somehow and we came back inside and I was completely covered. The garage door had fallen onto my back. I had a black stain on my suit and I walk in there, you know, and just to see Rabbi Sachs's face change from whatever they were talking about to, oh my gosh, Shimon, what happened? What happened? What can we do? What can we do? Is there something we can do? You know, and not only that, he could have gone to stay with Senator Lieberman that night. He offered to go stay with him, but we got the water out in time. The fact that he and Lady Elaine refused to leave, refused to say, we are staying here, we are going to be here. You know, I just felt like
he was real, genuine, a special person, and a great bracha that you had. Shem, we want to thank you for coming on in the middle of your night. Get back to sleep, try to catch a few more. And our heart goes out to you, our thoughts are with you, and you should have strength. And all the Jewish people, and really all the world who so valued him, should find strength during this time. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, guys.
We'll be in touch.
Great to see you.
All right, thanks, Shem.
Thank you.
You know, I want to share two other things. We only have a few minutes left that strike me. One of them, it's really personal reflections on this. One of them is, and I don't know if anyone else feels this way, not from a voyeuristic or a curiosity or a gossip, a lashon hara way, I have this aching desire to know what Rabbi Sacks was thinking about the end of his life. This was so private, so secretive, and he was so well thought out that had to have been intentional. The fact that he didn't speak often about the twice he had cancer before, and as many have pointed out, in contrast to others who've learned or taught or shared, he actually mentioned when I did that podcast with him, that interview 3 years ago, he mentioned having been through cancer twice, but only in the context of talking about challenges and failures in his life that he overcame. But he was so intentional. What he must have known what this meant and when it turned. And when did he decide and how did he decide? But most specifically, why did he decide to do it this way? He left us a legacy and he taught us so much. And I want to learn from his thinking about what was his thinking being private. And did he not want the attention? Did he not want to be the center, the focus? Did he not want the pity? Did he not want his family? Was it protective for his family that they not be overwhelmed, that they could have that private time? But clearly, very consciously, it was only determined to make the announcement that he was struggling with illness towards the very end. Yeah. And I'm so curious, again, not in a voyeuristic way, but we've learned so much. He leaves a whole legacy of learning. I want to learn from that decision, and I don't know that we'll ever know it. And I don't know that we're entitled to it or deserve it, but it's one thing that I've been very, very curious about. I don't know whether that struck both of you as well. The other thing is, his daughter, his youngest daughter, gave a eulogy. It was a very small funeral. And I think it's also extraordinary how private, how modest, how humble the whole process of the funeral and even of the Shiva in the morning have been, which is along the lines of his prioritizing his family above and first and foremost everything else. So I don't know if you listened to the eulogy, the hesped she gave. And she spoke about two aspects of her father and his relationship with them, with his children. One is that he let us be us and didn't force us to be him. Again, this resonates for me just as a rabbi and as a tiny, 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 incomparable nothing but our public life and our children, that what she took away was that as great as he was, that he let his children be them and didn't force them to be him. But the other thing that comes to mind, and my wife Yocheved and I were reflecting on this, and she was really giving me strong encouragement and insight, which I value greatly, is, you know, sometimes I'll say to my children, that, you know, did you read my article this week? Did you listen to my Parsha share this week? And I feel like I put a lot of effort, a lot of energy into it. And I love to share it with the whole world. But what I care most of all is to share it with my own children. You get feedback from others and you want that feedback from your own children to know that you are impacting them. And first of all, they're children and they're young children. And why would they or should they or why should I expect them to read it? But Yocheved said to me after listening to, I think her name is Gila, the youngest daughter, her words about her father. Did you hear her say a couple times that he would, in the kitchen while making the coffee, say, how are we going to solve global anti-Semitism?
Global anti-Semitism, right.
And Yocheved said to me, you know, don't you get it? Don't ask if they listened to the Parsha Shir. Just talk about the Divrei Torah you gave in the Parsha Shir. Don't ask them if they read your article. Engage them on the topic of your article. And that was so powerful to me, and I hope to be able to implement it. And it's another thing learning from him that wasn't explicit or overt. It was from a eulogy in passing. But that it sounds like he didn't impose himself. I doubt Rabbi Sacks said to his kids, have you read my latest book? You must read, I want a book report on my latest book. Instead, while making coffee or whatever she called it, I forgot, it was a much more British description of making coffee.
Tea and crumpets.
Whatever it was, that he would turn with that vigor, that enthusiasm and say, how are we going to solve global anti-Semitism? How are we solving assimilation. How are we solving? And as a rabbi or a leader or a public figure, that's such a better way of engaging children. So both of those things really, more personally, in my own personal reflections, really stuck out. I'm curious what both of you think.
Rabbi Brody?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how he's going to be replaced. I mean, there's many gedolim in the world and everyone can have their own gadol. But when you see everyone from Jewish Federations of North America who featured him many, many times, and you see youth organizations from NCSY to BBYO and everything in between, when you see different shuls of every denomination giving hespedim for him, who else is there? Who's everyone going to look to? So again, you can look to your own person and your own gadol and everyone, but who's that unifying force that was really always there that I think went underappreciated for many because he was just there, but there's no one else to replace that. It's for me, it's very, very sad, very scary.
He was a unique blend. He combined so many other forces that he was unique. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
See, I think Shem touched on it when he was here for Shabbos. I think it was 2015, 2016, somewhere around there, maybe 2014. But I actually pulled him aside on Sunday morning. I said, you know, Rabbi Sacks, as a young rabbi, what is the one piece of advice you would give me? What's one piece of career personal advice that you would give me? And he looked at me. I'll never forget. He points at my head. He says, my guess is that you're giving speeches from there. And then he taps me on the heart. He goes, I want you to start giving speeches from there. And that's really what made him so special was that he blended those two. I mean, you listen to Shem talk. It wasn't just his head, right? We read his books and his Torah and his knowledge and his wisdom. But he had such a, again, I didn't know him well, but you listen to Shem, you listen to so much of what's coming out. And as you described, it's the humanity. It's the music that played in his heart that really allowed it. And I think that's what touches people's soul. When it's genuine, when it's coming from the heart, when it's not just lip service, but it's something you believe and something you live by, that radiates with people.
Yeah, on the interview I did with him, and I can't encourage you strongly enough to listen because it's all him. It's all his wisdom. And it takes on even more meaning now after we've lost him. But he says, he talks about the importance of emoting. You have to emote. It's not just intellectual. It's not the heart. That was the word that he kept using. What we're missing, what we're lacking, being in touch with our emotions and emoting. Tonight we reflected on the loss of two irreplaceable, unique. And while many will set them up in contrast to one another because they perhaps were appreciated by different audiences, I imagine if you put Rav David Feinstein, Zatzal, and Rabbi Sacks, Zatzal in a room, they would have infinitely more in common than that divided them. I imagine they would be able to speak for endless hours and connect because our sacred Torah and a relationship with Hashem and the humility and the humanity they both had, they would have much, much more in common that divided them. And this is not necessarily our joyful behind the bima, our joking behind the bima. This is a somber behind the bima. It's in a week of Shiva for the loss of these two great individuals. Before we close it out, though, I do want to bring up, unfortunately, our anti-Semite of the week or our fighting anti-Semitism of the week.
Alton Brown.
Yeah, this is kind of a shame on you segment that we have every week where we basically continue to reinforce the notion that we have to take action, we have to speak up, we have to engage in advocacy. And if we don't do that for ourselves, nobody else will. We absolutely have to. Look at how we changed things when it came to an issue in our own community with the high school principal denied the Holocaust. And that's true with all these issues. So I was not familiar with Alton Brown. I'd never heard his name. Apparently he's a major star on the food network. I'm into eating food, but how it's made is so much my business.
He's really good. He's really good.
Is he good?
Yeah. Well, he really good.
He's like a so food scientist. He's very meticulous in the science of food and how things just have to be made.
Well, let's not talk about how good he is because he wasn't so good.
Well, up until today, he was really good.
And how he was analyzing politics in America. And he wrote a tweet, quote, "Do you think the camp uniforms will be striped like the ones at Auschwitz or will plaid be in vogue?" That was
his my question. What was he thinking?
Right.
What was he? So he walked it back.
Before he walked it back. Wait, Rabbi Moskowitz, before he walked it back, he doubled down. He wrote in a further tweet saying he doesn't have gold in his teeth. He's not so worried about these camps because he doesn't have gold that would be plucked from his teeth. And when he was challenged and when he was called out, first he apparently went on a tirade of profanity. And only then did he delete all the tweets.
Everything was deleted.
And then he posted the following. "I apologize for the flippant reference I made to the Holocaust in my tweet last night. It was not a reference I made for humorous effect, but rather to reflect how deeply frightened I am for our country. It was a very poor use of judgment and in poor taste." Now, again, I wonder, I wonder, I don't say this with certainty, if it weren't anti-Semitic, but it were some other form of hatred, bias, discrimination, would he still have a job? In the cancel culture that applies to everything but the anti-Semite, cancel culture world where we defend everybody but the Jew, would he still have a job? A lame apology a day late.
You know the answer to that. Of course he wouldn't have a job. And we allow people to delete tweets and go on with it. It's a shame. I honestly don't know what he was thinking of. On what planet is he living where that's a reasonable comparison, a reasonable analogy to make? Sometimes I wonder what goes through people's minds.
And didn't someone we know make a comment back to Twitter about this, and then they got banned or
a very good
thrown up at Twitter?
A good friend of Behind the Bima and of the BRS movement posted on Twitter about this, objecting to his anti-Semitic comments, and Twitter suspended her account.
Right.
Mind-boggling. Absolutely mind-boggling.
But tonight,
we could talk about Twitter, but we're not. Tonight's Shame on You is Alton Brown, and we call on the Food Network to suspend him, to put out comments about it, you know, to put out a lame apology a day late. And again, you got to love these apologies. I apologize, but really, I don't really need to apologize because I was just telling you how terrible this country is, how dangerous it is, and really, I believe that we're going to go in camps, and I don't have gold in my teeth, and it'll be striped like Auschwitz. It's horrific. Shame on Alton. What's his name? Alton Brown. He should be fired. Call the Food Network. Write the Food Network. Soon our website will help you be able to do that. Support the people that support and love us, and fight and boycott the people who discriminate against us. We're working on that project, including by the person, our friend, who was suspended by Twitter. But you'll hear more about that. I want to thank Rabbi Tzvi Ram for joining us tonight and sharing his personal reflections. Big thank you to Shem Kramer for waking up in the middle of the night. And we hope that for Klal Yisrael, for the Jewish people in the world, we should have happier weeks ahead. We shouldn't suffer loss. We should continue to benefit from the wonderful leaders that we have, please God, for many, many years to come. We have a lot of guests. This week, a lot of guests got back to us. And now it's just a question of slotting them into different dates. But a lot of very high profile, very exciting guests we're going to be having on. We're going to go behind the Bima, learn about their life, learn about their story. Until next time, stay happy, stay healthy, and stay holy.
Thank you for listening to Behind the Bima. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you next week for another peek behind the Bima.